Welcome to FedSoc Forums, a podcast of the Federal Society's Practice Groups. I'm Nate Kazmarek, Vice President and Director of Practice Groups at the Federal Society. For exclusive access to live recordings of FedSoc Forum programs, become a Federal Society member today at fedsoc.org.
Hello and welcome to this FedSoc Forum virtual call. Today, June 30th, 2025, we're delighted to host a Courthouse Steps decision program on Medina versus Planned Parenthood South Atlantic, which was decided last week by the court. My name is Kayla Kleist, and I am Deputy Director of Practice Groups here at the Federalist Society. As always, please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the experts on today's program, as the Federalist Society takes no position on particular legal or public policy issues. Now, in the interest of time, I will keep my introduction of our guest today brief, certainly more brief than their careers would deserve. So I highly recommend that if you're interested, you check out their impressive full bios at fedsoc.org. Today, we are fortunate to have with us John Bursch, who is Senior Counsel and Vice President of Appellate Advocacy at the Alliance Defending Freedom. Mr. Bursch has argued 12 U.S. Supreme Court cases and more than 30 state Supreme Court cases since 2011. Prior to coming to ADF, Mr. Bursch served as Solicitor General for the state of Michigan from 2011 to 2013. Before that, he ran a private firm, Bursch Law PLLC, where he represented Fortune 500 companies, Fortune and domestic governments, top public officials, and industry associations in high-profile cases, primarily on appeal. He was inducted into the American Academy for Appellate Lawyers and serves as a member of the American Law Institute. Also joining us today is Kyle Douglas Hodkins, who currently serves as a partner at Lahosky Keller, where he's a nationally recognized appellate specialist and chair of the firm's Texas appellate practice. Among his responsibilities, he represents businesses and complex commercial cases at the trial and appellate levels. For 2018 to 2021, Mr. Hodkins served as the Texas Solicitor General, the state's chief appellate litigator. In that role, he argued nearly 30 appeals and briefed dozens more at all levels of the state and federal judiciary. Mr. Hodkins argued 4 cases before the U.S. Supreme Court, 6 in the Texas Supreme Court, and 18 in the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Sixth Circuit. Before joining Lahosky Keller, Mr. Hodkins was a partner at Gibson, Dunn & Crutcher, where he's a member of the Appellate and Constitutional Law Practice Group. Lastly, joining us today as our moderator for today's conversation is Ryan Banger, currently serves as Senior Vice President of Strategic Initiatives and Special Counsel to the President at the Alliance Defending Freedom. He oversees ADF's government affairs and corporate engagement teams, as well as the Blackstone Legal Fellowship Program. He also advises executive leadership with strategic initiatives and appears as counsel for ADF clients. Before joining ADF, Mr. Banger served as the Deputy First Assistant Attorney General and Deputy for Legal Counsel in the Office of the Texas Attorney General. In those roles, he oversaw the state Special Litigation Unit, which handled critical litigation against the federal government, and oversaw multiple divisions within the office. Prior to that, he served as Deputy for Civil Litigation, or Missouri Attorney General Josh Hawley, overseeing the state's civil litigation divisions, including consumer protection and antitrust divisions. Prior to his government service, Mr. Banger was a litigation partner at Biggerbotz LLP, where he was a member of the firm's commercial litigation and appellate practice section. And I will leave it there. Thank you all for joining us today. I'll get off your screens and hand it over. Looking forward to a fabulous discussion. Mr. Banger, the floor is yours.
Wonderful. Thank you, Kayla. And I have the good pleasure of being with two good friends and a current colleague in John Bursch and a former colleague in Kyle Hodkins. And so really looking forward to this conversation today, October term 2024, as we were just discussing before we jumped on the podcast, is the gift that keeps on giving. And the final week of the term provided a number of blockbuster decisions, none more blockbuster-ish than the one we're going to be talking about today, Medina versus Planned Parenthood of South Atlantic. And I had the privilege of being with not just two fine lawyers, but two advocates who both presented argument before the court in this case on the winning side. So we're really looking forward to this conversation, and we have a real treat for our listeners today. John, I'll start with you. You were lead counsel for the state in this case. Could you please set up the issues and briefly describe the holding in the case? And really the question I'm getting at is, what was at stake and what was it that the court decided?
Well, there was a difference in how you view this case, depending on whether you were part of the press or whether you were part of the legal academy. In the press, this was litigated as a defunding Planned Parenthood case. But the legal issue that was presented was really a lot more esoteric than that. It was whether the any qualified provider provision of the Medicaid Act creates a private right that can be enforced under Section 1983. And South Carolina, like all the states, is a Medicaid administrator, and so it signs on to this Medicaid contract. The any qualified provider provision is just one, I think it's listed number 23, of about 87 or 88 things that a state must do if it's going to be administering Medicaid. And specifically, it says that a Medicaid beneficiary, so someone who is going to a doctor and they're receiving Medicaid benefits, may obtain the provider, the doctor, of their selection, essentially. And so the issue is whether that created a private right. Now, that sounds like a narrow issue, although even on its face, it's not, because there are thousands and thousands of disqualifications of Medicaid providers across the country. And so whether an individual can go to federal court and bring a 1983 action in all those cases is tremendously important to states who are administering Medicaid. But the issue is actually much bigger than that, because the question of when you have a private right in a spending clause statute that allows you to go to federal court and sue and seek damages and potentially attorney fee shifting applies in every nook and cranny of spending clause statutes, and states administer many of these. And so the Supreme Court over the last 30 years or so has gone back and forth about the stringency of the test to apply to identify private rights. On some days, it's had a really high bar. On other days, it's had a really low bar. And in this case, they stood firm with the high bar, which is a bar that they rearticulated two terms ago in Tlefsky. And in a 6-3 decision, the court, in a decision authored by Justice Gorsuch, said that when you're talking about someone who may obtain something, you're talking about a benefit, you're not talking about a right. There was no crystal clear rights-creating language in this provision, and therefore South Carolina prevailed. That means that Planned Parenthood cannot recruit a beneficiary as it did here and go to federal court and file a 1983 action.
Well, and Kyle, I want to bring you in here because you know, that's an excellent summary of what was at stake in the case. You have the privilege of arguing on behalf of the United States. You spent some time at the U.S. Solicitor General's office very recently, and you presented an argument on behalf of the federal government. Give us a little bit about why did the federal government see fit to jump into this case to the extent that you can, and give us a little bit about the national implications.
Yeah, for sure. So I guess there's, you know, a couple reasons why the federal government participated here. One is that the case is about the meaning of a federal statute, and it's very common at the Supreme Court for the Solicitor General's office to weigh in whenever the meaning of a federal statute is at issue. Obviously, the United States has a strong interest in the correct application of its own laws. I guess the second angle, though, is that, you know, because this was a spending clause statute, the Medicaid Act, the relationship between the federal government and the states becomes important. The Supreme Court has said that spending clause statutes are sort of in the nature of a contract between the federal government and the states. And so I think it's important for the federal government in cases like this to have a voice at the table, to speak to sort of what the terms of those contracts with the states are, what the obligations of the states are. I think John's summary of this case was really excellent. But to just sort of even, you know, abstract it further, this is really like a 1983 case about, you know, when can you bring a 1983 action to vindicate a federal right? And there have been a string of cases over the past few decades about spending clause statutes in particular, and when those actually confer on somebody a right to sue. The court previously in decades gone by took sort of a more lax approach to whether a spending clause statute created a right. But in recent years has taken a more narrow view. And we see that in Justice Gorsuch's opinion last week, where he sort of marches through the jurisprudential history and focuses on what the court is looking for now for the actual creation of a right. And that really does matter to the federal government as a, you know, for lack of a better term, a contracting partner with the states.
I'd like to pick up on what you just said there, Kyle, and jump into the majority opinion, because it seemed like there's a little tension between the majority and the dissent about what exactly was happening in this case. Was this a break from prior precedent? Was this a modification of the bar that was set in Tlefsky? Have we made it even more difficult to identify rights within spending clause statutes? Or is this just simply a straight application of Gonzaga and Tlefsky? So John, I'll start with you, and then Kyle, I would love to get your perspectives on this. Did this case, was this just a straight sort of continuation, straight line continuation of Tlefsky, major break from prior precedent? How do you see it, John?
Well, I think it's easy for Kyle and I, as the advocates, saying that this was a straightforward application of Tlefsky and Gonzaga, to say that it was a straightforward application. Justice Jackson, interestingly, was the justice who wrote Tlefsky, and she's the one who said you need to have clear, unambiguous rights-creating language in a Medicaid provision in order for it to create a private right that's enforceable under 1983. And so when you just kind of take that at face value, it would seem like this is a natural application of that. There was no language in the Any Qualified Provider provision that unambiguously put a state on notice that this was creating a right, because there was no rights-creating language in the provision. Now, Justice Jackson, simultaneously writing the dissent here and the majority in Tlefsky, doesn't see it quite that way. She says that Tlefsky announced this high test, and Tlefsky was the easy case because there you had two provisions they were looking at that were set aside in a Bill of Rights for people who were nursing home residents. And the word right was used repeatedly, like over two dozen times throughout these statutes. And so there it's very easy to identify a right. And she accuses the majority of basically taking Tlefsky and making that the new standard. But I don't think that's really accurate. I think Justice Gorsuch has it right, that Tlefsky was a straightforward application of Gonzaga, and that this case, Medina, was a straightforward application of Tlefsky.
Yeah, it feels a little like a Rorschach test when you look at this language, sort of like, what do you want to see in it? I think Justice Gorsuch's opinion for the majority is a really clean, straightforward application of the test that first emerged in Gonzaga, 20-something years ago, and was reaffirmed in Tlefsky. Tlefsky says we're looking for clear, unmistakable rights-creating language, and it only arises in atypical statutes. And I think Justice Gorsuch's majority opinion faithfully applies that. It says, in Tlefsky, as John just said, you've got the word right multiple times in the statute, over two dozen times. Here, there's no reference to the word right. That's not to say we're adopting a magic words test, but there's no other unmistakable rights-creating language. And then on top of that, there's nothing atypical about this statute. The any qualified provider provision is one of 87 different provisions in this laundry list of things that state Medicaid plans are supposed to include. And so it's hard to look at, one isolated provision, the 23rd provision in that 87-point list, and say, oh, yeah, that's atypical. We're going to say that one creates a right.
So yeah. One of the reasons I think the court took this case with the Fourth Circuit below, which addressed this case twice, you had Judge Wilkinson both times saying clearly there's language in the Medicaid statute that creates a right. Judge Richardson calling for clarity from the U.S. Supreme Court. Tlefsky's decided, it's sent back down. It's decided again by the Fourth Circuit. Again, Richardson says, insufficient clarity from the U.S. Supreme Court. And then here, in this case, the majority was very clear that prior precedents, Wilder, Wright, and Blessing in particular, so cases that fell before Gonzaga in this long sort of march toward a more restrictive standard, the court said clearly lower courts should not be relying on these cases anymore. And very clearly, I think, disclaimed those cases. I think he effectively overturned them. And so the question I have for you guys is, do you feel like the court's move in clearly repudiating Wright and Wilder and Blessing is going to provide that kind of clarity that Judge Richardson was calling for?
I think so. If you look at the 5-2 circuit split over the issue presented here, the any qualified provider provision, all five circuits that ruled in favor of the plaintiffs in those cases relied at least in part on Wilder, Wright, and Blessing, which had a much lower standard. In those cases, the court suggested that simply a focus on a beneficiary class that was not so vague that it couldn't be judicially enforceable was enough. One of those cases, they even relied on legislative history in order to find that clear focus on the benefited class. So you can understand why that's such a low bar compared to the atypical case that Kyle mentioned in Tlefsky or here in Medina. The two circuits that had gone the other way, the Fifth and the Eighth, had eschewed the Wilder, Wright, Blessing trilogy and just focused on the Gonzaga high standard. And so I think that does make a difference. It certainly made a difference to Judge Richardson below. As you mentioned in his concurrences, he said, look, these three cases are still on the books. The Supreme Court hasn't overruled them. I'm just a lowly court of appeals judge. I don't have the ability to just ignore those, even though effectively that's what the majority did in Tlefsky. We need more guidance. And I think Justice Gorsuch's opinion provides that guidance definitively.
It is a little strange, in my opinion, that lower courts were still citing Wilder and Wright and Blessing. There was a case 10 years ago called Armstrong, which included a footnote sort of recognizing that the analytical framework applied in those cases has been repudiated. The Supreme Court used the word repudiated, which effectively means overruled. And yet, despite that pronouncement 10 years ago, there are lower courts still sort of invoking those decisions. And in that sense, it's sort of surprising that the court even had to go here. This came up at oral argument. I think, John, you got asked. I know I got asked, like, you know, do we need to say something about these old cases? And I think the answer was, yeah, you probably should, because apparently lower courts are still confused, even after Armstrong repudiated them. And so now we've got this discussion from Justice Gorsuch. It's not in a footnote. It's above the line in the body of the opinion, saying stop citing these cases, right? Wilder or Blessing are no longer the way we think about this area of law. You should look at Gonzaga and the subsequent cases when you're deciding whether something creates a private right. And that really, to answer your question, Ryan, really should clear up any confusion. I think at this point it would be extremely surprising for a lower court to cite Wilder, Wright, and Blessing. It would obviously be wrong to do so.
But a point to be made about that, that would be a really good subject of a future webinar, is the current court's reluctance to actually overturn precedent. Now, you saw this for years when everybody knew that the Lemon test was dead, and yet the court did not definitively say that it was dead, and some lower courts continued to apply it. This has happened in other areas too. And even here, Justice Gorsuch's opinion says lower courts should not rely on these three cases, but he never says the magic word reversed or overturned or anything like that. So how you can have precedent that no one should rely on, that's not entirely clear to me, but they just seem to be allergic to saying that we're overturning our prior decisions.
Well, now you're putting me in a position where I have to try to defend that. I think as a formless matter, the statute in Wilder is no longer operative. It got repealed. And so I think we have to give them a pass for not using the word overruled or overturned, because it's about a statute that doesn't exist anymore. So it's not like we're taking a different view of that statute. But John, your macro point is, I think spot on. At the end of the day, there's just no value to these precedents anymore, and people should not be citing them.
Well, and that's an interesting discussion. And certainly as I was reading the opinion myself, I sort of got echoes of Coach Kennedy. Like, this has not been the law for years. How could you continue to cite these cases? So that allergy to overturning expressly was certainly, it seemed like it was evident here. One of the things that I thought was interesting was this conversation between Justice Gorsuch and Justice Jackson. Of course, as you mentioned, John, Justice Jackson, the author of Tlaibsky. And so sort of seeing the opinion that she had written used in a way that I think she didn't necessarily approve of in this case. But one of the interesting parts of this conversation was, how exactly does the Tlaibsky test now apply when it comes to spending clause statutes? Clearly, in the Tlaibsky case, you had the Federal Nursing Home Reform Act, which used the word rights multiple times. So there was the word rights was in the statute itself, clearly delineating that there were rights involved, at least according to the court in Tlaibsky. Here, the word rights was completely absent from the provision of the Medicaid statute that was at issue, the any qualified provider provision. And in his opinion, Justice Gorsuch goes through and compares the FNHRA that was at issue in Tlaibsky and the Medicaid statute that was issued here and says, look, there are all sorts of differences. The word rights never appears anywhere in the Medicaid statute. There's an aggregate compliance mechanism here, which I think we can talk about, which was important to him. He also pointed out that, at least with respect to the Medicaid statute, it just didn't have any of these other hallmarks. It was more of a obligation, a statute that laid obligations on states for compliance, but it didn't necessarily have that individual-centric or plaintiff-centric flavor that the FNHRA. I'm just curious, do you see those kinds of distinctions between these two statutes? And the big question, which I think is what Justice Jackson got at in her dissent, was she said, I think we're just creating a magic words test. She even said that in her dissent. She said, this looks like a magic words test. So the question to you all is, are there real distinctions here, or are we just devolving to a magic words test, in the words of Justice Jackson?
Yeah, I don't think it's quite a magic words test. There was a lot of discussion about that at oral argument. And Justice Kavanaugh was one of several justices who said we should adopt a magic words test, because then there won't be any confusion going forward. We'll have given Congress clear instruction what they have to say. We'll have told lower courts how they need to examine these statutes. But the court didn't go that far. But I think it was the combination of not having any clear rights creating words There was no mention of rights or privileges or immunities or the traditional rights creating no person shall. None of like that, of those kinds of words existed here. And then I think that aggregate focus was an important one, because as Kyle's mentioned a couple of times now, this was just number 23 on a list of 87. And they were not even things that states have to do. They were simply things that a plan must include in order for the Secretary of Health and Human Services to approve the plan and start the money flowing to the state as it administers Medicaid. And in FINRA, it too was an aggregate. This is what has to be on the plan, but they kind of set apart and then put a box around this long section that said Bill of Rights. And so everybody knew that this wasn't just the standard benefit list in a plan. And I think that to respond to Justice Jackson, that's where this really comes down. Are you talking about benefits, which are replete in these statutes? You know, if you go back to Wilder and Wright and Blessing, the standard was, well, did someone benefit from this? Did it have an individual focus? Well, every spending clause provision or contract, you know, statute has that kind of focus. That's the whole purpose. You're giving benefits to people, but you're allowing the states to administer it. So if you're going to look past that, I think Tlefsky is a perfect template of how Congress has to do that. Could they find, say, a private right somewhere in that list of 87 things with more specific rights creating language? That's certainly possible. The word right does appear in this particular portion of the Medicaid Act. But the fact that it appears in other sections, but not in any qualified provider provision, is just further evidence that Congress was creating a benefit and not a right here.
Yeah, when Congress wants to create a right, it knows how to do so, as Tlefsky illustrates. It set out, as John said, this sort of special Bill of Rights within the statutory scheme. When you look at the provision at issue here in Medina, there's nothing like that. It looks like a conversation between the states and the federal government about, we're going to give you money, you're going to have a Medicaid plan, these are the things we're looking for. And it's not even saying, you know, these are the things that people have a right to. It's really phrased in terms of, you know, these are the things that the Secretary of HHS is looking to when deciding whether to approve a plan or to approve modifications to a plan or to dole out funding. We haven't talked about this much yet, but, you know, one thing the court takes into account in its analysis is that the statute already does sort of have consequences baked in. If a state does not comply with this 87-point list, there can be the loss of funding, there can be the non-approval of plan modifications and things like that. And holistically, you know, sort of looking at that context, paired with the fact that there's no unmistakable rights creating language, the majority treats this as a pretty easy case.
And to Kyle's point about how Congress knows how to do this, in FINRA, although it wasn't a provision at issue in Tlefsky, it specifically includes on that Bill of Rights the right to choose the care person that you want, the doctor who's going to be in your nursing home room. And that they didn't use similar language in this statute is a strong indication that they meant to treat them differently.
Certainly, certainly. And you did bring up something else, Kyle, that was prominent at the argument, although not so much in the opinion, this concept of alternative remedies or opportunities created by the states for those affected by removal of benefits or privileges to challenge that at the state level through an administrative process. And that really didn't make an appearance in the opinion as much. I mean, it was sort of obliquely mentioned in the majority opinion. I'm just curious, do you think that's going to remain a factor in the analysis, or has that been more or less swept to the side based on what happened in this opinion?
So I think that is still part of the analysis. I think that, you know, we're looking for all of the clues that Congress gave us as to whether it's creating an individual right. I think it's unmistakable. I think this comes from Gonzaga directly. One of the clues is, has Congress built in some sort of remedial scheme or some sort of consequences for noncompliance with the federal dictates? I don't think that did a lot of work here. As you noted, it certainly wasn't something that the majority opinion, you know, emphasized as sort of a pivotal point. But, you know, if we're just looking at the statute, trying to understand what Congress was doing, I mean, the fact that Congress says, if you don't do this, these are the bad things that can happen to you. You know, you can lose funding, not get approval, stuff like that. That sort of suggests that, you know, Congress didn't feel that creating a right here was necessary because there's other ways that the law can be enforced. Back-end remedial schemes are also, you know, important to a different line of cases called Rancho Palos Verdes and Sea Clamors. There's a line of cases that says, you know, even if Congress has created a right, if it has provided a robust remedial scheme of its own for an individual, that can actually supplant a 1983 remedy such that we're not going to allow a 1983 cause of action. I just only mentioned that. That did not come into play here. Nobody was arguing that the provision at issue here in Medina had such an extensive, elaborate back-end remedial scheme so as to supplant 1983. This entire case, the work was being done on the front end, whether there was a creation of a right in the first place.
Yeah. One thing I think our listeners may be interested in hearing about was something that was fronted by Justice Gorsuch in the early parts of his opinion, and that was a robust discussion about sort of theory of spending clause statutes and what are they. And he talked about them more as contracts or even treaties between sovereigns. And it was a very interesting conversation because I think it set up the subsequent parts of the decision. But this idea that you can create rights, individual rights, out of contracts or treaties, and sort of the dissonance there, which I think Justice Thomas very clearly picked up on in his sole concurrence. But give our listeners a little flavor of why was that conversation about framing spending clause statutes more in the way of contracts or treaties? Why was that important, and how might that have significance going forward in this area?
Well, I think it informs the question of how high you set the bar. And when you're talking about a spending clause statute, all of a sudden you're talking about things that Congress does not have a right under the Constitution to impose on states unilaterally. It's something that it can only do with the state's agreement. We're going to give you a carrot and you can respond to it, but there are no sticks in the spending clause context, only carrots. And so if that's the case, then there should be a really high bar, as there would in any contract, to basically creating a third party beneficiary right to go forward and sue. And the court didn't articulate it in those terms in this opinion, but you know, there's been some concurrences and dissents in past opinions where they've kind of talked about that concept. But it makes sense that if in a private party contract, third parties very, very rarely have the opportunity to bring a lawsuit to enforce their rights, the exact same thing would have to be true in a contract between a state and the federal government.
Yeah, I mean, the burdens imposed by 1983 lawsuits on states are very serious, and they can be quite hefty, whether it's, you know, the actual attorney's fees or whatever else, and the cost and burden of litigation. I think the high level idea is that, you know, look, if we're going to make states, if we're going to hoist onto states Section 1983 lawsuits and Section 1983 liability, we need to be sure that the state knows what it's signing up for. And if it's not clear to the state that this is what they were signing up for, that they were signing up to get sued under 1983, and deal with all the burdens and expenses that go along with that, then we're not going to say that a right is created in the first place. We're not going to allow 1983 action unless it was clear.
I want to read you some language from Justice Jackson's dissent, because I think it bears on the question that we just talked about, which was the way that the way the statute was framed being significant to the court's disposition. She says, "The opinion the court hands down today suggests that as a practical matter, the character of the law, and in particular, whether it was enacted under Congress's spending power, is all but dispositive of the required rights determination." So she sort of looked through the majority opinion and said, well, this entire discussion about whether or not it's a spending clause statute and the nature of those types of statutes is really what's driving the decision today. And so I thought that was an interesting observation. And the question I have is, do you think that Tlebsky may be the last decision we'll ever get from the Supreme Court finding an individual right buried inside a spending clause statute? Is Justice Jackson correct that we have now effectively ended the ability of litigants to fashion and craft individual rights out of spending clause statutes? Or is she overstating the case with that critique?
Well, I think she was right when she wrote Tlebsky, when she said it is atypical that the court finds private rights in spending clause statutes. And so is Tlebsky a one-off? Probably not. But is it unusual or atypical? Yes. And it should be for the reasons that we just discussed.
Yeah, I can't improve on that answer.
Outstanding. One of the other things that she said, which I thought, you know, I called this in sort of my notes, doomsday language, which she began her opinion with sort of a very, purple prose, so to speak. She said a century and a half after the passage of the Civil Rights Act in the 1870s, the project of stymieing one of the country's great civil rights laws continues. And of course, she's speaking there about Section 1983. And that was an interesting note because it came into conversation with Justice Thomas's concurrence, where he said, well, hold on a minute here. Section 1983 was never created to enforce administrative benefits created through Medicaid statute or the Medicare statute. It was really focused on the civil rights era, the Reconstruction era statutes that were passed to defend civil rights. And I thought that was an interesting comment because buried in that comment by Justice Jackson was this assumption that every benefit, everything that an individual can obtain from the government is itself constitutive of a civil right. And I thought that was an interesting conversation that didn't really happen, but it was sort of in the ether between Justice Thomas and Justice Jackson about, well, what exactly is a civil right? What exactly is the nature of this thing that Congress actually intended to protect when it passed Section 1983? And I was just curious if you all wanted to comment about that interesting sort of theoretical conversation that the two of them were having.
Well, I don't think that was as much a conversation about implied rights resulting in 1983 actions in spending clause statutes, but kind of a general theory of Section 1983. Justice Thomas's concurrence, which no other justice joined, lays out pretty forcefully that courts have allowed 1983 actions that are far broader than anything that Congress anticipated at the time of enactment. He points out that in the early days after 1983 became the law of the land, there's only a small handful of cases in the federal courts. And as you mentioned, they deal almost exclusively with Reconstruction era issues where people's rights were being violated. And in contrast today, he says there are tens of thousands of cases that are filed every year. I don't remember specifically the number, 60,000 comes to mind, but I might be wrong about that.
I think that's right.
So there's just been this explosion of 1983 enforcement actions that he doesn't think Congress ever intended. And so when Justice Jackson is really getting her hackles up and talking about doomsday, I think she's referring to the potential that a majority in the future could start to slim down 1983 scope outside the spending clause context. And that would be a huge development, obviously. So that's a dialogue to keep an eye on.
Yeah, no, I agree. It's worth watching. I think a lot of it is driven by the sense that, like, you know, the creation of a federal right is a big deal. Rights are a big deal, right? There's some, it's the notion that sort of any federal statute that just happens to confer a benefit on somebody automatically would become a right that's enforceable through the civil rights statute is, I think, a premise that everybody should reject, right? It can't possibly be the case that anytime the federal government benefits somebody, suddenly that becomes enforceable through sort of, you know, the greatest landmark civil rights statute in our country's history following the Civil War. Obviously, Justice Jackson in this case would hold that this provision is sufficient to clear that bar, but I think that, you know, that's sort of where the debate is playing out.
Mm. And I noted in the majority opinion, Justice Gorsuch presciently noted that when you create rights for some, you create obligations and burdens for others. And mm-hmm. I think that was very much on the mind of the majority, that rights are two-sided animals. They both create benefits for some, but that benefit is not cost-free and it comes from someplace else. In many cases, it does. And so you have this instance where especially the types of rights that are created by spending clause statutes, which necessarily imply the taxation power of Congress to distribute these benefits, there's a burden placed someplace else, particularly in the spending clause context. And so I think that's a very, very interesting conversation to keep our eyes on. Really, last question to you all. I think we've really covered this case well. What do you think this case portends for the future? Where do you see this line of case law developing further? Do you think there are some bigger questions yet to address in the rights, sort of 1983 implied rights spending clause space? Or do you think this is going to be the final word for a while?
It's hard to know. It certainly is not going to be the final word from the federal courts. It may be the final word from the U.S. Supreme Court, because there are literally hundreds, if not thousands, of spending clause provisions that are hanging out there. And states have been subjected to 1983 lawsuits in innumerable scenarios, far outside the any qualified provider provision or the two provisions at issue in the FINRA case. And so I think you're going to see lower courts trying to apply this decision going forward to other provisions that have not yet been definitively resolved by lower courts. You may also see some states going back and trying to replow ground that they may have lost at the circuit court level for other provisions previously that, in light of this opinion, are just clearly wrong on their face. But over time, I think there's going to be a funnel, a dwindling of these types of lawsuits against states And that really benefits everyone, because the whole purpose of these acts is to make sure that benefits flow to people. And when a state unexpectedly is being sued for damages and attorney fee shifting, every one of those dollars, as well as all the time and energy it creates, is diverting the benefit from the people it's supposed to go to, the needy people on the ground, and instead diverting it to plaintiffs and plaintiffs' lawyers. And so over the long haul, I think the systems will operate better and benefits will flow in even more abundance to those who are supposed to be receiving them as a result of this decision. Whether another circuit split develops over a particular provision, it's possible, but really early to say right now.
Yeah, I think that's right. I don't know of any specific disputes in the pipeline right now that could potentially reach the Supreme Court over other spending clause statutes, but I do think we're likely to not see a lot of Supreme Court cases about this in the future. We've got Pilevsky now from a couple of years ago, which has an example of the atypical statute that is just so overwhelmingly obviously rights creating that there's no way to reach any alternative conclusion. And now we've got Medina showing a statute that, you know, uses, you know, terms like may obtain as not being enough to create a right. I think that's given the lower courts a couple of guideposts. We'll see how that plays out in future litigation. But the fact that Medina, I think, sort of, you know, solidifies Telesky's pronouncement that we're looking for atypical statutes should clear up a lot of confusion in lower courts going forward.
Well, thank you, Kyle. And the only thing that was not atypical about this particular podcast was the high quality that both of you brought to the conversation. Both of you are excellent advocates, and that showed at the argument and clearly in the results. So thank you both for making time to do this. Really grateful for that. And Kayla, we will turn it back to you.
Well, I will echo those thanks. Really appreciate you all taking the time out of your days to share your expertise and insight and break down this case and where we may be headed. To our listeners, thank you for tuning in and choosing this program. We welcome listener feedback by email at fedsocforums@fedsoc.org. And as always, keep an eye on our website and your emails for announcements about other upcoming virtual events. With that, thank you all for joining us today. We are adjourned.
Thank you for listening to this episode of FedSoc Forums, a podcast of the Federal Society's Practice Groups. For more information about the Federal Society, the Practice Groups, and to become a Federal Society member, please visit our website at fedsoc.org.